And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How are you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you, Lucas?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, man. We are having some crazy weather up here. I don't know if you've noticed that we've been having some snow, and Portland had the first snow it has had in April ever. And it's been kind of crazy. It's been in the 20s in the morning up here.
It's been fairly cold here at night. We've been getting down into the low 30s, which is common for this year. But what isn't common is how cold it's been during the day. We've had lows in the 50s. I mean, highs in the 50s, and it's been raining. And we got some mixed snow and rain last week. So we got some snow down here in southern Oregon.
Yeah, and let's go ahead and get started with the show. And I just want to talk about something real quick before we get into our news, and it is some sad news, unfortunately. I want to talk about a friend of mine who is a cannabis activist who sadly passed away, and she was a friend of the show. She was never on the show, but she was certainly an inspiration to me, and her name was Lori Jackson, and I don't know any details about her passing away and or anything about the service or anything, but I first met Lori in 2015 at a cannabis lobby day down in Olympia. And we had some discussions, and we got her plugged into some things here in Tacoma, the local Democratic Party, which I had been doing since 08. And the next time I saw Lori, she was at a Democratic Party meeting, and she had two big issues that she worked on. And she was an older lady. I never knew her age. But her two big issues, Dig, were Medicare for All and cannabis legalization, specifically your issue, home grows. And I just want to talk about her influence on those two things real quick. We have a campaign here in Washington called the Red Berets, and they make berets and give them around the country for Medicare for All. Well, Lori made hundreds of these, Dig. I don't remember how many it was, but it was hundreds that she knitted. And then she gave them out all across the country. And there's actually a picture out there online with Nina Turner of Ohio, the representative there from in the House of Representatives, wearing one of Lori's berets. And it's really cool. And then the other thing, her issue was cannabis. And when I met her, she was growing cannabis that year. She had a couple of big CBD plants in her backyard, some THC plants. And she had grown so much the years before that she was still smoking on it like two or three years later. So she was growing some big old plants, Dig. I never did see her garden, but she kind of lived out here in towards Spanaway.
Oh, okay. A little more in the sticks.
Yeah, and she was growing, and she said all she would use was fish meal. She was always so proud of that because she'd be like, my stuff doesn't have any pesticides in it or heavy metals because I just use fish meal.
I've seen a lot of growers have good success with using fish meal and fish emulsion and fish emulsion in their plants and not much else and have really good results.
Yeah, and she was so proud of that. And we have two representatives here, Representative Steve Conway and Senator Steve or Representative Steve Kirby and Senator Steve Conway. And I'm telling you, Dig, every meeting I would go to, Aunt Lori was there in their face going, when are you going to legalize home grow? Medical cannabis patients need home grow. Medical cannabis patients need a tax break. Every time she would bring it up, no matter what meeting we were at, she would raise her hand and she would bring it up. And she was always
beautiful.
Yeah. And she was a true inspiration. And when I got to even know her better, her life and the things that she went through and in her life was an inspiration. The woman's strength and her beauty and her eloquence and how she talked about things. I just love Lori Jackson and I miss her. I haven't seen her since COVID started. And I have to say, I can say for sure that Steve Conway and Representative Steve Kirby are both now medical cannabis supporters, and they are both homegrow supporters. And I am 100% sure that that happened because of Lori Jackson. And I want to give her a moment of silence real quick here on the Cannabis Corner. Thank you, Lori.
Yeah, rest in peace, Lori Jackson. It sounds like you were a real warrior for the plant.
And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa special report.
And this week, our news starts in New Mexico, one of my favorite states in the union. Have you ever been to New Mexico?
I've been through, but I haven't been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time there, although I've heard good things, and there are Whataburgers there, so I can't be so mad at them, right?
Yeah, and I spent a little time at a Boy Scout ranch there called Philmont. I worked there 2 years, and I went there one time as a Boy Scout.
Just a, you told me some wild stories about that place.
Yeah, my boss had a pound behind his seat in his truck the second year I went. So all these stories about Boy Scouts being all innocent and everything, I think I probably learned all my bad habits in life in Boy Scouts, but that's a whole nother story. But it's just a beautiful state. I love New Mexico. They call it the high desert in a lot of places, and it's just a really nice place. And I can imagine now that they have recreational cannabis, that it's just a really nice place to go to and get out there on that high desert and consume some cannabis. But, you know, on to our story. New Mexico had a medical cannabis system, Dig, and this is a pretty familiar story. Recreational cannabis comes in, and then patients get worried because of all the long lines, product shortages, and everything like that. And we've seen this before, huh?
Yeah, we've seen it in a lot of states that have kind of a smaller medical system, and then they're like, well, let's just use the existing medical infrastructure to supply a new recreational market. And what you have is in states where there's not a super huge culture of cultivation and overgrowing, like in Oregon, we didn't have much of a problem. In some states, they don't have much of a problem. But in places like New Mexico, they don't have this big, robust grow culture. A bunch of growers didn't see it coming and prepare for this rush. So what happened is you had a medical system that was small for patients, giving them what they needed specifically. And then when you open that up to the glut of customers that a new recreational state provides, you end up shortchanging the patients, which are on whose backs you got this legalization in the first place.
Yeah, that's kind of similar to what happened in Washington. Although we never had a rush on the stores, and we weren't ever really worried about any shortages. And this is one of the complaints the patient that was in the story I wrote said, that they were telling her, like, hey, you should keep getting your medical card. But she's like, why? There's no benefits. And so that's kind of where patients kind of land is, you know, they can start getting their medicine as the more flower comes in, but then there's no benefits. You know, there's no tax breaks, no, you can give them to the front of the line. No.
What about increased home grow plant counts?
Yeah, it's none of that. Now, I think New Mexico does have home grow. So I don't think New Mexico is as bad as some of them. But New Jersey, they just passed, they're just getting their rec law going in New Jersey. And I just saw an article today, patients in New Jersey are worrying. That's a state that's going to have problems because they have medical cannabis before, but it's not that great. And no home grows. I think New Jersey really is going to have some problems.
Probably, yeah, because there's going to be a gray market and a black market anywhere you don't have home grow.
Now, on to another state that we have talked about before, and that is Montana. And Montana legalized cannabis in 2020. They've been working hard on it. They had some activists try to roll it back, but it's like, yeah, right. Whenever you get it, it's going to be like we talked about last show. When you do get rights, especially something like this is making the state so much money, it's going to be really hard to roll it back. And what a showing in Montana for the first quarter of the year cannabis sales. What is it, like up over $79
million? $73 million so far this year alone, Lucas. It says here that with nearly 15.9 million in sales, medical came in at 9.8. Montana providers have sold 72.9 million in cannabis products. So it's just crazy. Just in the month of March alone, $15.9 million in sales. Now, what I will say is a lot of old heads, you know, would kind of want to go to Montana, but we wouldn't because, you know, it's all fun and good. It's all beautiful and anything, but it would kind of not be great to go and see all this beauty and not be able to enjoy cannabis. So I think what is happening is everyone is getting hip to the fact that, hey, I can catch a flight into Montana, go, you know, go enjoy the great outdoors, and now I can get high there. And I think that's a big draw.
Yeah, and that's one thing they were saying, that right now tourism is contributing to Montana because they have tourism all year round, but big-time tourism has not hit yet. So I think in Montana, we are going to see even bigger numbers. And like you said, and like I was just talking about in New Mexico, it's really nothing like consuming cannabis out in the outdoors. So I think you're right. I think it's just going to grow in popularity, and Montana is going to be kind of become one of those big states that is going to surprise everybody when it comes to cannabis.
Yeah, really. I think it really will.
All right, so we're going to get on to our next story is in Mississippi and another state. We're just doing all these updates on states that we covered before and bringing the audience up to date with what's going on them. But, you know, I'm really happy with this story because I'm from Alabama. It's right there by Mississippi. Alabama has medical cannabis, but, man, dig, Mississippi's coming out with their medical cannabis system.
They are going to be working with Metric, you know, spelled M-E-T-R-C, a seed-to-sale platform, right? So they're going to try to use Metric in Mississippi. Now, we have discussed the problems with seed-to-sale tracking on this podcast. On this radio show, kind of ad nauseum. But I just like to rehash some of it. Anytime that they roll this out anywhere, it never works. And I'll prove it to you really quick. Does Washington State have a deferment problem? Yes. Well, there you go. Metric doesn't work. So Metric is a dumb expense that doesn't work. It's there strictly to make regulators comfortable. It doesn't actually provide any useful data. Because as soon as you enact it, people immediately figure out how to go around it. So it's pointless. Now, some of the things I also see is there's still some local drama. So cities and counties have a May 2 deadline in Mississippi to determine if they will opt out of the bill. So they are able to opt out, and a lot of people are – for example, Horn Lakes Board of Aldermen has already said it will opt out from the program as it works through zoning issues. So, like, a lot of people are already trying to find backdoor ways to opt their, like, areas out of it. And they're trying to find reasons other than being anti-cannabis to do it. And so you're going to see more and more of that as their normal arguments, they're, like, puritanical and backwards don't work. They're going to try to go through weird backdoor zoning laws and stuff like that to keep cannabis out of their areas.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, the seed to sale thing, it was just a whole big waste of time here in Washington State. I did an article on that. I think they spent like almost $2 million, but it's probably way more than that on that thing. I was still getting, I did a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request on that to see how much they were spending, and they kind of slow walked it on me, Dick. They were sending me, they sent me the figures on it, $2 million, but then they kept sending me like emails for like 2 years with all the backup documents. So it was just a whole big waste of time. And like you said, everybody just gets around it. We'll see what happens in Mississippi. One of the things I found fascinating in Mississippi, though, that is not in a lot of states, and I'm kind of surprised it's in Mississippi, is this whole thing with what's called reciprocity. So if you and I go to Mississippi, which I'd be actually a little wary to do this, you can get two 15-day passes per year to be like a guest medical cannabis patient. So you can get that pass and go to Mississippi dispensaries and get medical cannabis. I found that fascinating.
That's cool. Oklahoma does something similar, but I think they give you more than like 15 days. I think it's like 99 days or 30 days or something, but you got to do it in advance a ways.
Yeah, I think Hawaii has something similar too. And I wanted to comment too on Mississippi's qualifying condition list, the list of diseases and illnesses that you will have to be able to get a medical cannabis card. That too is significant and very long and a little bit more thorough than Washington State even. So, you know, it does have problems. Of course, it is Mississippi, so it's not going to be the best thing in the world. You got to go back every 6 months.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, same with Florida, but it's only $25 a year for your card.
Oh, wow. That's okay. That's a cheap medical card.
Yeah, but you got to make a doctor's appointment, though, twice a year. Oh, so that might run. And it's one. I want the audience to listen to this. They say that it has to be a doctor that you, quote unquote, have a bona fide relationship with. Do you know where that language came from, Dig? Straight out of Washington State. 5052. It was the first time I ever heard
y'all
that.
Y'all don't have pot doctors there.
No, that's the first time I ever heard that.
That's listen. The only reason you have to pay a doctor is to get a piece of paper that says it's okay. Listen, medical cannabis is like most cannabis use is medicinal. The reason the doctor's there is so the state can say it's medical. We all know it's medical. Like, that's frustrating because you should be, you're paying, we have a private medical system, right? You're allowed to go to your doctor and ask him about Xanax and ask him about this and ask him about this. But now if I ask him about cannabis, I got to know this guy. All these old retirees running around Mississippi pill popping and shopping doctors. But if you want a little bit of herb, now you have to develop a relationship with some guy and you have to pay him a bunch of money, because that's what a relationship with a doctor is in a private healthcare system, is a paid relationship with someone. So it's very dystopian, and I don't like that. You should be able to pay any doctor to prescribe you cannabis. You can pay any doctor to prescribe you anything else.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous, too, because the doctor – you know what a doctor has to do to get qualified to administer a medical cannabis card in Mississippi? 8 hours of continuing education. But then you got to go and have a bona fide relationship with that guy when anybody could take that same 8 hours of continuing education and recommend medical cannabis. I don't want to say anybody. Let's say a naturopath or a nurse or someone. But, yeah, we could just have, like you call them, pot doctors. And that's how it used to be in Washington State. That's how I got my first card. And they have those in Oregon, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they have, well, like the, I've been to one there. They have, they'll be like alternative health clinics, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, we don't have.
You will go in there and you're basically paying like a doctor in a Hawaiian shirt. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be stereotypical, but everyone that's ever signed to my card has been wearing a Hawaiian shirt. So I think it's just a look. But you pay a doctor in a Hawaiian shirt. But see, I've had the same pot doctor for 5 years.
Yeah, me too. Well, since 5052, it used to be there was one downtown. It was right by my dispensary. And I just go in to get my card and then walk right into the dispensary and down in Opera Alley in downtown Tacoma. I just love that place down there. But now, but when 5052 hit, I got really lucky and I found a place over here in UP. And yeah, I go to them every year, but it's always been expensive. It's like $150, $120, $100.
No, it's $175. Oregon recently passed something for veterans who are disabled like me. So I think my pot doctor made his last $175 off me, because I think if I keep my paperwork continuous, I can just keep refiling with the state. It's assumed that the conditions I qualify for aren't going to get significantly better. So they're just going to go ahead and I think grandfather the veterans in kind of permanently. You just, because the state filing fees are way cheaper. I think it's like, the most expensive thing is the doctor. I think for veterans, it's like $20, or it's free if you're like 100% disabled or something. And then, so I don't end up paying the state very much. It's just doing paperwork, which I don't mind doing.
Yeah, it's the same here. I have to go in every year and get registered. But I wish they would do a permanent medical cannabis card too, because like you, my disability being blind is not going away. And so I keep having to pay this money every year and being like, for a substance that I have literally used since I was 19 years old, that makes me feel way better and I can get through the day as a blind person pretty much no problem with the help of medical cannabis. And it's very helpful. I got to go every year and ask some guy to let me use it. It's all about the money, Dig. They want that system. And in Washington State, we talked about this last show, they don't want you to have medical cannabis. They want you on the pharmaceuticals, medical cannabis patients. You're a faker.
So, yeah, I understand that argument, but I don't. Like, you pays your money and you get your drugs. That's how our medical system works. So I just don't know why in 2022, with where people are getting denied life-saving care because they don't have money, why we're pretending there's any ethics to drugs in America other than I pays my money and I gets the drugs I want. So if you want cannabis to treat your issue, then you pays your money and you get the drugs you want. That's America, right?
So we're going to shift gears here. We had a really heavy kind of bringing the audience up to date there at the beginning of the show, a lot of medical cannabis there. So let's kind of talk about something, I guess a little fun, but maybe not necessarily, but kind of interesting. They came out with a top weed cities in the country, or top cannabis cities in the country. And I was telling Dig before, it's like, so Portland's number two. Seattle is number six. Number one, of course, is Denver. But, you know, I was telling Dig before the show, I mean, Atlanta has great cannabis. And Orlando does, too. There's a lot of cities in the country that have really great cannabis that aren't on the list. But I like your perspective on this, Dig. What makes a city a great cannabis city?
Weed is legal, and there are either few cops or the cops don't care. So that's all it takes to be a weed city. I've traveled all over Oregon. I'm more of a fan of rural vacations, so I'm probably not going to go to downtown Denver to vacation. I would probably go to like an Airbnb in one of the rural towns outside Denver. So a lot of why I don't have problems smoking weed on vacation is because I'm kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And as a general rule, we aren't even usually close enough to people on our vacation for them to smell the weed. They can see me smoking a cigarette, right? But when I think that in the Northwest, people have a pretty laissez-faire attitude about cannabis use. And I think that you'll see that as well on the list of these cities. I think what makes these cities so special is that a lot of them are pretty laissez-faire about consumption in public. Mm-hmm. So you're less likely to get hassled in Portland or Denver or Sacramento or Las Vegas for smoking a joint in public than you would in like Houston, Texas.
Yeah, I was looking at the list. I was a little surprised Sacramento was on there. It's not necessarily known as a cannabis hub, but it did make the list. So that what was the number 10 city? There was a lot of cities in California.
Well, there's a number 10 is Phoenix, Arizona.
Ah, Phoenix.
And we actually do have one southern city on this, 11, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Oh, I thought it was just the top 10.
Well, they got 11 here, so.
Yeah, so they tried to throw Virginia Beach on there. Okay, great, yeah.
And they said that Richmond came up in the top 20.
Wow, interesting.
So, you know, and I've heard this recently on another cannabis media entity. I can't remember the name. I listened to a few just because it's fun to do your research by listening to other shows. But they were talking about this like vibrant underground grow scene in Virginia that is almost, and in Kentucky too, that is almost as like prolific as like Oregon was like in the 90s and stuff. So I'm almost wondering if once some of those southern states go legal and become more acceptable, if all of a sudden we're going to have like a mini like Northwest, like kind of pop up in Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, in that area, and just all of a sudden the Blue Mountains are going to turn green. And I think that would be cool.
Yeah, I think so too, because down south, the state with the reputation for the best cannabis is Kentucky. I mean,
yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It really is. We met a guy, and it already kind of had this reputation, but one time we were at the beach at spring break, we met somebody from Kentucky, and they were like, you want to smoke some weed? We're like, heck yeah. So, yeah, it does have that reputation. It's very rural out there. Now, Virginia is having some problems, though, because they got a Republican governor, and he's trying to crack down on some things. But they did do a couple things to kind of improve some medical cannabis. Maybe we'll cover that story next show. But Virginia has been in the news. I had not heard about that on Virginia. So that's good to hear. And yeah, let's turn them Blue Ridge Mountains to Green Ridge Mountains. How about that? This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by The Lunar by Dip Devices. Learn more about this product wherever this episode of the Cannabis Corner is syndicated. And we are back for this week's interview, and this week we are joined by the founder and CEO of Halo, which is an I-502 licensed processor, Lo Friesen. How are you doing today, Lo?
I'm doing great, Lucas. Super happy to be here. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, it really is great to have you on the show. I've been out and about in the cannabis community from time to time, and your business, Halo, is always coming up in various topics and things, and so it's great to have you on the show. And I was looking into your background, and I saw you had a background in chemistry and maybe a little work in the medical field. How did that kind of prepare you to get into the cannabis industry, and how did you actually get started into cannabis?
Well, yeah, I'm a total chemistry nerd, and my life path led me to medicine. So I was working at a hospital and got some really awesome medical experience working with patients. And I actually didn't get into medical school. And instead of continuing to pursue that, I decided to follow another opportunity that opened itself up to me, which was the cannabis industry, mainly because at the time, which is about, 2014, 2013, that's when recreational really started to take off. And it was more and more prevalent as an opportunity. In addition to that, the opioid crisis was getting worse and worse. I'm from the Midwest, and so my community was suffering from that and still is. And it was just kind of this like alignment. There's a lot of doctors in my family, and we started talking about cannabis and how it was an alternative to some of the drug treatments and could help with addiction and offer some support for addiction. Mm-hmm. And so it just seemed like a good fit. And I booked a one-way ticket to Seattle and decided to dip my toe into things. I ended up meeting the folks at Eden Labs, who we really connected on both the cannabis level and then just extraction science. And they actually hired me. So I got to experience the extraction, botanical extraction side of things before I entered the cannabis industry specifically. So I felt very grateful for that because it allowed me to understand botanicals as a whole and all the different extraction methods, as well as become a cannabis consumer from a legal state. So I moved here from Chicago, where I was like texting my dealer, and we had it pretty good back then, honestly. They would deliver it to us, and we had a little menu. Nice. But it was nothing like walking into a legal cannabis store and seeing the incredible number of products that are available to you. So again, I'm a chemistry nerd, and that really inspired me to understand how cannabis interacts with my body. And that is kind of the foundation of how Halo was born.
So what have been some of the challenges that you faced kind of getting into the cannabis industry from a place that the Midwest is not, well, hasn't been known for a leader in cannabis? I know Illinois is really coming on strong with their recreational use. And moving out here to Washington and just the 502 regulations and working through that with the various businesses that you have worked with, what have been some of the challenges that you faced, and how did you get through some of those?
Well, getting licensed in the state is not easy, and I had some speed bumps. I didn't necessarily intend to start my own business here. The goal actually has always been to bring cannabis experience back to my hometown in Ohio. And but as I got into this industry and started learning more about the products that were available and what was lacking, I really figured that my experience, my chemistry background, could really lend itself to providing better products for consumers. So I had some challenges were, business conflicts. Like, I was going to go into business with somebody and that didn't work out. And then I found myself able to purchase a license. It was a really good, good opportunity that presented itself. But entering this market is a little bit intimidating, especially in Washington, because there's just so many products available and it's hyper competitive. So getting our branding and our story and like our why of why we're here and doing what we're doing was really important to me. And that's where we developed our mission. So Halo's mission is to help anyone get more out of life using our cannabis products. And so I had those business conflicts. I had a trademark issue. I had to change my name pretty early on after launching in the market. Through a business conflict, I actually got arrested. And oh, wow. So I had quite a few challenges, and it was a wild ride. It still is. But I will say, that aside, I felt like it just felt right. The market was ready, and I felt really confident in what we were doing and what we were offering the industry. And so I was totally down to get through those challenges in order to launch Halo in 2017.
Oh, awesome. So I also noticed in your mission, a big part of it is education. And I was a cannabis instructor over at TCC for a little while, and I've been a big proponent of education as part of the mission of Cannabis Corners, to educate people driving around Tacoma just on the basic things about cannabis. So why do you think is it important that a brand like yourself that is pretty big in Washington State puts it right up at the top that education is one of their most important things to pay attention to?
Well, first, I want to thank you for supporting education in cannabis and being a teacher for us. But education's always been super important because, well, first, when I entered the cannabis industry and became a consumer here, I realized how little information there was available about products, about how they were made, where they came from, not only from the companies themselves, but also from the bud tenders selling the product. And not to their fault, you know, they're not necessarily offered all that many resources to understand what they're selling people. So I realized that was lacking in the industry. And I think one of the reasons why I love chemistry is because you can get down to the nitty gritty of why things happen or how things operate. And so that's just the questioning person in me and trying to understand, you know, I'm that person that walks into the cannabis store and asks like 50 questions.
Yeah.
So I realized how important education was going to be part of this industry because in order to develop this industry, to grow this industry, and to defeat all the stigmas that have been developed over decades, we are going to have to take that education on ourselves. And informed consumers are vital for us to continue fostering this industry in a way that we want to see it. And an example I always bring up is that society is very familiar with alcohol, you know, how to use alcohol, how it makes you feel. We see, you know, our parent, we grow up, you know, understanding how it affects our parents maybe, or seeing it in movies. And there are also, like, on the other side with medical treatments, for example, there's tons of resources to understand, you know, how medicine helps us, or like taking Advil, how it can affect you. But there haven't been resources for understanding how cannabis can help us, both on a medical level as well as a recreational level, how to use it safely and to get what you're looking for in terms of its experience. So I knew right away that this was going to be an important part of our company because it's just important for the industry as a whole, and creating access to this information will support consumers in being able to find the products that they're looking for. So many, I'm sure you've had an experience where, you know, somebody was explaining, oh, I tried this one product and it made me feel this, like I laughed for hours or what, or it made me paint a whole painting. And then you're trying to find that same type of product and you can't articulate it, or you can't get your hands on it. And so we want to show people that there's so much more than just, what maybe society is telling you about cannabis, and that consumers themselves can be the deciding factor with what they're looking for. And so that's really where it came from, really creating access to this information so that consumers can make the best decision for them and to get the right product in their hands. Comparing it to medicine, a lot of times people go in saying like, I'm looking for a product to help me sleep. Maybe a bud tender recommended a product and it didn't really help them all that much. A lot of times people will write it off. They say cannabis just isn't for me, or maybe they had a bad experience. And so it's also about expectation setting, that cannabis isn't a one size fits all product. Like, every product is different and every body is different. All of us have different body chemistry. And so in order for us to get closer to helping consumers find the product that's right for them, whether it is the product to help them go to sleep or it is the product to get them jazzed and experience music in the way that cannabis can help us do, we need to be able to do that trial and error. And so it's a little bit of expectation setting. And then the last level of it is helping consumers understand that you should care about what you're putting into your body. And I think that will lead to our conversation around transparency, because if you care about, you know, what food you're eating, for example, you should care about what products you're inhaling.
Yeah, and that does segue really great into my next question, which is about transparency. And it's kind of well known that consumers' biggest issue with the CBD market, and we can kind of see this a little more broadly across the United States because it's legal all the way in all the states. So more people are using it, and so then you got more feedback, more complaints. But one of the biggest things is the labeling and transparency, and people just don't understand it. They aren't sure what the label means, and we get back to the education piece. But another thing is they get the product and it doesn't do what they think it's going to do. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a secret, or not secret, that a lot of the labels are not correct. And a lot of the hemp is not tested correctly. Washington State, you know, they kind of like have practically done away with our traceability system. So I know there's been a lot of complaints about transparency on that, and how, you know, there's a medical cannabis that says the underground market might be even a little more safe for pesticides than the regulated market sometimes. And so let's just talk a little bit about transparency, and how do you achieve that? How do you really achieve transparency when we were just mentioning that people aren't necessarily educated on the product? Mm-hmm. So how do we achieve transparency in something that has traditionally been kind of swept aside, and a lot of people don't want to know about it, and it can get a little complicated?
Yeah. Well, traditionally, this industry has been kind of like shrouded, kept in secret. You're talking about the underground market that does still exist. But it's been shut off, right? Because we had to conceal it. But now we're in a place where being transparent and showing the general public, you know, what it takes to produce these products, these great products, and in a safe way, is vital for us to continue to grow as an industry. And so that lends itself to the fact that, you know, speaking back to the education piece, people just don't know enough about cannabis. And so being transparent is a really great way to create trust in our community. And that's what we need for this industry. The regulators have an agenda and their goals with the program, but they're not necessarily supported, for example, by the federal government, right? We're still in a legal industry in the federal government's eyes. And so, you know, they're doing the best they can and making changes all the time. But the regulations aren't necessarily set up to foster an industry of transparency. You mentioned labeling, especially with the CBD products. We don't know, you know, they're not required to test their products. So you don't even know if any CBD is in there. There's a lot of like gray area in terms of how you can advertise the product, of what information you can put on the product itself, because it's gray area whether or not CBD products are even legal to sell, right? Mm-hmm. in this country. And so it's doing us a little bit of a disservice because we're not required to do a lot of that. And so, again, we just have to look out for the best interest of our consumers and the best interest of our industry. How are we going to progress together in a positive way? Where do we want to become? Who do we want to become as an industry? And that starts now. We have to set the bar. And that's why Halo, you know, we post all of our certificates of analysis on our website. We've been pesticide testing and spot checking heavy metals for years. And that's because I think my chemistry background helps me understand, you know, that this is a very complex product. It's a complex plant. When we extract it, it becomes more complex. And so we have to take that step and go above and beyond what we're required, because what we're required to do isn't enough. Transparency comes down to just that, sharing what we know as much as we can, and that I mentioned our certificates of analysis, the testing that we do to make sure the products are safe, that involves certificates and testing, but it also involves focus groups, people try the product before we put it out to make sure that it fits our standards, both from an experience level and a flavor level. You know, does it taste like cannabis? And then also it allows us to be held accountable, and consumers can drive that. If consumers are expecting and requesting transparency from their manufacturers, then we have to be transparent. And so we hope that we're setting the bar. We offer tours of our facility to the public so that you can see the behind the curtains and how all that we put into making the products that we make. And you can ask us questions and take pictures. I mean, it's an amazing experience to see the magic behind cannabis extraction. But that is our commitment, our consumer contract, to offer education and to be transparent. And that starts with, you know, the information that we share on our website, but also down to the packaging. You mentioned labeling and how important that is and how convoluted it can become. Well, we try to simplify it as much as possible and create access to as much information as we can so that you can find what you care about on our packaging. But yeah, generally consumers have a right to have access to this information. And then the next level of it is bud tenders, the people behind the counter that are there to help serve you as a consumer and find the best product for you. They're not always able to have that transparent conversation with suppliers. And so we consistently make sure that we're available to the bud tenders. We have a certification program that bud tenders can take about not just cannabis information as a whole and cannabis science, but also Halo and like the intricacies of what we do, so that they know exactly, they can answer as many questions as they can for consumers and provide as much information as they can using our certification program. But it's up to us to ensure the consumer's safety. And thankfully the legislature is making steps to not only encourage, but require pesticide testing in Washington cannabis products now. So we've made great strides as an industry, and it is consumer driven and it is manufacturer driven. So we have to set our own bar.
Yeah, very true. And I believe there are rules underway in Washington State to start getting most products or all products, at least the flower, tested for pesticides. So
yeah, April 2nd, all products sold to store or all products produced after April 2nd will be required to be pesticide tested.
That is great news.
Yes, it is.
So one of the questions that I'm really excited to ask you about, since you do have a chemistry background, is this, and I do see that you have some products that have Delta 10 THC in it, and currently we're having sort of this wave of Delta 8 all across the country. Every day there's Delta 8 in the headlines all across the country, states banning it, states trying to ban it. So talk to, and then, of course, the main event, the cannabinoid that everybody purchases in the stores is THC, which is Delta 9 THC. So tell us a little bit about, and maybe just real quick in short version, explain what all these Delta 10s, 8 and 9s actually mean.
Yeah, you did an episode on Delta 8 and all the crazy legislation that was happening. But you mentioned it. Delta 9 THC is what the plant naturally produces. And when THC is the molecule that we're talking about, but there are some chemically, it's the same, but there are different changes that can happen that will basically create a different shape for it. And so when each of these different forms, Delta 8, Delta 9, or Delta 10, interact with our endocannabinoid system, our receptors, because they're different shapes, they fit into those receptors differently, which then triggers our body to react differently to it. So Delta 9, we're very familiar with it, know and love it. It gives us that bliss, that euphoria feeling, that typical cannabis high. Delta 10 is completely different. It's not as intoxicating, but it is supremely energizing. So that's just something to note about it. It is like three shots of espresso. Oh, and then Delta 8 is, I would say, we don't produce any Delta 8 products. Delta 8 isn't that special to me. It doesn't offer as unique of an experience. And that's really what we're trying to capture, these unique experiences that cannabis can provide. The other thing about Delta 8 is that oftentimes you're finding products that are produced from CBD that are using harsh chemicals to convert CBD into Delta 8. So that's a chemical synthetic conversion. The way we produce Delta 10 is actually through just temperature and pressure. So we're taking our Delta 9 THC that we extract through our CO2 extraction process and taking it through an extra step, exposing it to temperatures and pressures that convert that Delta 9 into Delta 10. We never use chemicals to convert that product. It's all temperature and pressure, which we're really proud of, because a lot of folks think you have to use these solvents, and we're here to say that you don't.
Good to hear. Yeah, so thanks for that information on the Delta 8 and Delta 9s and Delta 10s. It really can get a little confusing. So the next question I want to ask you is about supporting the LGBTQ community in the cannabis industry. And I was recently at a conference, a Full Spectrum conference put on by a mutual friend named Neil, and he has a nonprofit called the Full Spectrum that supports LGBTQ in the cannabis industry. And a drag duo stopped by the conference and was mentioning they were working with you and working on some common goals to support LGBTQ in the cannabis industry. Do you want to just talk about that for a minute? And how important is it for the cannabis industry to support our LGBTQ neighbors?
I am so glad you brought up the Full Spectrum group. Neil's doing incredible work creating access to like educational funding and supporting the LGBTQ community with cannabis information. The LGBTQ community actually helped cannabis legalization and creating access to cannabis for medical patients. It also gave us credibility. It gave the industry credibility for treating symptoms. It started with the AIDS epidemic and how cannabis can help with symptom treatment for AIDS patients. And Dennis Perone was one of the folks that helped get California's Prop 215 to market. And another thing I learned actually from the Full Spectrum is that the LGBTQ community is two times as likely to use cannabis than the straight community. And so we have to support this LGBTQ community because they helped us get where we are today, and understanding how cannabis can help us medically and even recreationally. So it's easy for us to do that, to support groups like Full Spectrum. You mentioned Lucci. We actually have a cannabis product dedicated to them that'll get you ready to dance, ready to create, ready to love. And that product supports the Lavender Rights Project. Love is Love is another product that we created in conjunction with Play They for the first year. And then the second year we did it, we supported Pure Seattle. And the purpose of these products is really to highlight this community and different ways that we as consumers can support the LGBTQ community. And then, of course, creating familiarity around trans lives and different ways that cannabis can be used to create a community to gather. Cannabis as a plant has for centuries been a community oriented plant and a place for us to share and share experiences and support each other. So we are very proud to support the LGBTQ community, and it's a no brainer because they helped us get to this legal industry that we have today.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I really appreciate your work and Neil's too on this topic.
Yeah, and I want to highlight that they didn't, the LGBTQ community, like during the AIDS epidemic, didn't just serve the LGBTQ patients. You know, they served all patients and created a very open environment for people to feel safe and to understand how this product and plant could help them with symptoms. And so I commend that the LGBTQ community for, you know, serving their community, but also recognizing when others are in need and welcoming them as well.
Yeah, that spirit really was alive and well when I first got into medical cannabis in Washington State back in 2013, 2012, around in that time. That spirit, I can say, definitely carried up through the medical cannabis dispensaries that were a direct line back to that time, because San Francisco is not that far from here. And so it really, that spirit was in medical cannabis when I first came into it, that you could help everybody with the plant because it was so abundant. And so it was really a way to help everybody. So I'm really glad you brought that up. So we're about to get out of here. Tell the audience how they can get in touch with you and your website. And is there anything else you'd like to leave us with?
I super appreciate you having me, Lucas. You can get in touch with me through our website, which is halocannabis.com. Halo is spelled H-E-Y-L-O, which is a play on words. There or on our Instagram, Halo Cannabis. And I encourage everybody to come take a tour. You can visit us, book a tour on our website, and again, see the magic behind the scenes here. But I'm excited for our education to continue supporting this industry. We have an amazing YouTube series that deep dives into cannabis science. And to challenge consumers to really think about the types of products and the types of companies that they want to support in this industry, because cannabis legalization is right around the corner, and we're gearing up for that. And education is going to be vital for the rest of the country to be able to adopt cannabis in the way that we want to see it, that it helping them get more out of their life. So that's what's on my mind right now. And I'm just excited for consumers to learn more and be empowered in their choices.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show, Lo.
Thank you, Lucas.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by The Lunar by Dip Devices. Learn more about this product wherever this episode of the Cannabis Corner is syndicated. Right, so now we're going to get on to our It's a Bus segment, and this It's a Bus takes us down to the border. And I just want to talk about real quick and highlight how the continued drug war makes dangerous situations for people. And in this case, we had a couple individuals that actually tried to smuggle cannabis across the border in a very interesting way. What were they doing, Dick?
The Coast Guard seized 155 pounds of marijuana Wednesday, April 6, 2022, near South Padre Island. So the Coast Guard crew members saw three people swimming across the Brownsville ship channel at 2 a.m. with bundles. Now, I gotta say, Lucas, if you've ever been down to South Padre, it's a party place for like kids in Texas, a lot of kids in South Texas, Southeast Texas, down near Corpus Christi and Houston and all that area, all that swampy, like wet area, go down to South Padre to party. And if you know anything about the Brownsville ship channel, it is disgusting. It's filled with chemicals and regret. It's just not a good place to be. So imagining that these two guys swimming across with like bundles of weed, it makes me like kind of grossed out, like anyone would smoke weed like that, because that's disgusting.
Yeah, one of my oldest friends died of flesh-eating bacteria that he got from crabbing in the water in Brownsville.
Ugh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, that's a whole nother story there. But yeah, it's a very disgusting area when it comes to the oceans down there. And, this is another situation where we were told that these kind of things were going to stop happening when legalization comes, but it just hasn't happened because, as we've mentioned, that piecemeal nature, cannabis still is illegal in Texas. So it's a lot of profit to be bringing those 155 pounds across the border there in Texas.
Oh, and I would like to say to any of my Texas compadres down there that would like to keep weed illegal, the more states that legalize in this country, the more cannabis that's going to go into Texas, whether you like it or not. That's all I'd like to say.
Yeah, it's just going to keep coming in. Back in the 90s, we knew you could go to Texas and get an ounce for $10 in El Paso. So, and you could get pounds for like, who knows, like $500 and stuff. So that was like 1990.
I will say, if you have access to safe, regulated cannabis or a good home-grown cannabis, you definitely should consume that, not any cannabis you can get in Texas.
Yeah, absolutely. So we really need to end this drug war and get this thing regulated so these kind of things can stop happening, because more police, more people being unsafe, and more tainted cannabis. If that actually 155 pounds would have made it across, yeah, like you were saying, it's really disgusting. Who knows where it would have went?
I'm looking at these bundles, like they're watertight in theory. I wouldn't want any weed out of that.
Yeah. So that is our show for today, and we are about to get out of here. I hope you have a good week, Dig.
Hey, you too, Lucas.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Folsch for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.